concerned by this, and why I'm giving this talk this evening, the origin of things, is because you can include some of the starting points of other religions and see just how that starting point is used and reflected upon and employed in the way of Buddhism. Be careful here that to notice that I call this the origin of things rather than the creation of things, because the word creation always implies that there's some being or something doing the creating. Whereas when I talk about origin of things, it's talking of this thing as being a natural process, the things which occurs without any person doing the originating. And it becomes a much more accurate and much more powerful way of looking at life, to look in terms of origins rather than people who do the originating, doing the creating. And when we start to look at where most religions start, about the origin of the world, the first thing one can notice in Buddhism, that before even answering that question, where did the world come about, what is the origin of the world, but straight away the Buddhism departs from other religions, maybe the exception of Hinduism and Taoism, in that it does not describe the world in material terms, in terms of just places and things and bodies. But the Eastern religions always recognize that the greatest component of what we call the world is not out there, but in here. It's not made of atoms and molecules and stuff, but it's made of the mind. If you read any of the books about Buddhism, the Buddha classified the world, classified existence into five categories. One category was for things, material, and the other four categories were the mind, the inner person. And it just is significant that 80% was concerned with the mind, and only 20% concerned with material. And indeed, one can see that the, especially European Christianity, and those religions which, if you like, deify the world, which create too much attention on the material things outside and too little on the inside, create much problem with a human being. One monk once commented that even something like the Sermon on the Mount, in the Bible, it was very materialistic. You take, for example, the meek will inherit the earth. It's like a real estate agent's dream, isn't it? And I don't know what they would do for native title. The meek will inherit the earth. This is not really supposed to be the goal of any religions, not worldly possessions or worldly goods. When the Buddha was talking about the origin, he wasn't concerned with just the origin of the physical world. He was much more concerned with the origin of the other 80%, the mental world, the inner world, the world of the mind, the heart. That was more interesting. And indeed, though the Buddha did, and Buddhism does place more attention on the mind, because I mention this, I should actually say that the Buddha did say something about the origin of the physical world. But the origin of the physical world was something vast and huge. And when the Buddha talked about many, many world cycles, whole eons of existence, an eon of existence in the Buddhist cosmology shared by the Hindu cosmology, is a time between the Big Bangs and the Big Crunches. The whole universe systems coming into existence and then passing away again. But not the mind passing away, but the mind transcending the material world. And even though that the whole of what we call material stuff can go into this great cataclysm at the end of this universe, even so, the mind continues. But this was the Buddha was talking about this, and he even made the point that he could recall many cycles of of big bangs and big crunches, expansions and contractions of the universe. And specifically, this is what he said and what he meant. Then the beings at the end of this cycle get reborn in realms of pure mind, not needing to depend upon physical stuff. And this has always been the emphasis of Buddhism, and one can see a striking difference between that emphasis which sees the mind as primary and physical things secondary, with the Western material world which sees things as primary and the mind as something secondary. It even comes as a point, why do people get shocked when we have our outer body experiences? Why do people get a bit surprised when, that story I like to say about the professor in this university in the middle of England who was very interested in the shape of people's heads and used to look out for students in his university who had a rather odd skull shapes, and that was like his almost like hobby, and he was doing a lot of research into skull shapes. And he found one young student who had a rather odd skull shape, gave him a CAT scan, and found he had no brain. And he was full of cerebral fluid. Now, where the usual brain had 80 millimeters of brain stuff, this guy had only 1 millimeter surrounding the cortex. And the rest was all cerebral fluid. Here was a fellow who, according to the words of the professor, had what amounted to no brain, but was an honours student in mathematics at a university in England, who was socially well adjusted, and actually, even though his mother might have said that a few times, actually he always thought he was the same as everyone else, and acted and looked the same as everyone else. Whereas modern psychology assumes that the mind is some side effect of having a brain. The facts are different, and certainly the Buddhism would always agree that the mind is the forerunner, the mind is the main thing, material things are secondary. And what happens when we take the opposite attitude towards life, that things are primary and the mind is secondary? What happens is we have a society which worships material things, which thinks that the material life is the be-all and end-all of life, which thinks that the goal of life is to gain power over the material world, to control weather, to control the cycles of famine and plenty, to control the cycles of health and sickness. To control the physical world becomes the aim of many people in this world. Whereas the Buddha has a different aim, because understanding the primacy of the mind, one can endure the uncertainties of the physical world, and one doesn't try and control them, when one knows the mind can transcend them. When one knows the mind can transcend sickness and even death. When one knows that the mind can be happy even though the body may be in pain. Not as a theory, but as an experience. Then it changes the whole emphasis on what's important and what isn't. So when the Buddha was talking about the origin of the world, he wasn't so concerned with the origin of material matter. He'd see material matter come and go in great universal cataclysms and originations. He was more concerned with something which transcends that, the mind. And so, in Buddhism, when one talks about the origin of this world, the world is with a capital W, capital O-R-L-D, and includes the mind as well. It makes the mind primary. What is the origin of this mind of ours? Or rather, what is the origin of our inner world? And that has always been the goal of Buddhism, to try and find the origin of this inner world. What is your world anyway? Now, when we talk about world, is it really just, you know, some planet Earth? With trees, with grass, with animals, with buildings and cities, rivers and roads and oceans. Is that really what we mean by the word world? When you look at it, the world outside is only just a partial ingredient of the whole story. Our world is what we make inside of the experiences of life. That is the world, isn't it? One can live in a very rich country like Australia and be totally despondent, have more suffering inside of us than someone who is living in a country like Rwanda, or someone who is living in a country torn apart by war, by famine, by drought, poverty. One can have more suffering here in Perth than one can have in one of these countries. Why? It's because the main component of the world is not what's out there, it's but what we make of it. It's why that an old story which someone told me some years ago, someone who volunteered to do some noble social service in Ethiopia some years ago, during the time of one of these great famines, volunteered and got assigned to one of the UN camps where people were crawling on their hands and knees to come to these camps with just rags on their back, seeking for food and water to survive. Unfortunately, that this particular camp did not have enough to keep everyone alive. And her job was to go outside of the camp every morning, outside of the fences meant to keep people out, and to choose, she was given a number every morning, to choose so many people, so many of the refugees who had crawled there the night before, to come in, be fed, be healed, to survive. And there were some who she knew were left outside who would be dead by the following morning. That's all they could do, because they only had so much food, so much medicine. If they spread it out too thinly, everyone would die. It was better to save some than to allow everyone to die. And she had to choose who. When this lady told this story to one of the monk replied, "That must have been a terrible thing to do. To have to choose who would live and who would die. How do you cope with that?" The lady in question told this monk that it might seem that way to an outsider, which was a terrible situation to be in, but actually the experience in reality was inspiring for her. It was one of the most moving times of her life, not one of the most dreadful times. She said it was moving because the nobility of those refugees waiting outside to come in was such that they didn't push one another, didn't say take me, not even take my child. They had a sense of serenity, a sense of take her, not me. A sense of high-mindedness in enormous and acute suffering, which so uplifted this lady's faith in human beings, which so encouraged her in what is possible in abject diversity, in abject adversity, that she became inspired. What wonderful people can be, even though they know they will die, they will let someone else go first. After that small conversation, the monk asked the lady what she was doing now she returned home. This was actually to London. The lady said she was now working in the education department in London. What was that like? Actually, now that's suffering. She said that working in the education department of a big city, heated, air-conditioned, safe, warm, supplied with food, that was much worse than being outside a camp where people were dying. You know, it's not the external situation which makes the most suffering in life, it's the internal reaction to it, how we deal with it. And this is what that person found. And this is just an example. When we're talking about the origin of the world, it's what we make out of it. There lies the origin. Once we realize the origin of the world is not so much out there, but what we do with it, that's where our world originates from. It gives us a marvelous understanding of the truth, and also a great sense of power over this world. If we make this world, then we can make it happy, peaceful, or we can make it painful. These sorts of understandings you may have heard before. Even when I used to go and visit jails and visit prisoners, even the prisoners would realize that a jail is just what you make of it. They used to say, you can do it hard or you can cut it sweet. It's up to you. And each one of us is the same. When we realize that the origin of the world lies with us, it's up to us to make that a peaceful, happy, pleasant, warm world, or a world of great suffering, anger, depression, cold. And this becomes such a beautiful teaching of the Buddhism. If the world was just out there, we'd have very little hope to create happiness. All we can do is pray and hope for the luck. If we realize that the origin of the world lies with us, it means that we have the chance and opportunity of doing something. When we have the opportunity and chance of doing something, we start to see, well, what world do I live in? Do you live in a warm world, a loving world, a caring world, a forgiving world, or a world of anger, a world of negativity, depression, or what? You have made that world, is what the Buddha said. And also, you can unmake that world. You can make this world whichever way you wish. It's hard work, but it can be done. And how do we make our world? When you look at a building, how did this building come about? You look at its origins, where it all came from. When you want to make or unmake your world, one learns, how did my world come about? What caused it? When you know what caused it, you know how to build a world. And this is why that we spend a lot of time in the Buddhist practice looking for the origins of states of mind, the causes for states of mind. If you are jealous, where did jealousy come from? If you are angry, where did anger come from? If you are happy, where did happiness come from? If you are at peace, where did peace come from? This becomes what in Buddhism, they have even got a word for this, and it's a Pali word called Yonisamanasikara, the work of the mind which goes back to the source. Literally, it means the work of the mind which goes back to the womb. The womb being the source, not a woman's, your mother's womb, the source of things, where everything came from. And this becomes the way of investigating in the Buddhist path. A questioning which doesn't go all over the place, but questioning which leads to the source of things. So you can take something like anger, and the way this Yonisamanasikara, the work of the mind which goes back to the source, happens, instead of you saying that anger, I want to get rid of it, you say, anger, where did it come from? How did this whole thing arise? What's the source, the origin of this? Things have an origin, and that origin is not created outside of you. It's not created by some god outside. It's not created by your husband or your wife, Mr. Keating, the world outside. It's created inside of you. Origins within, not origins without. So when the work of the mind, which goes back to the source, starts to look not outside for the origin of something like anger, but looks inside. The next time you get angry, ask for the cause. And don't, when you're asking for the cause, the origin of things, sometimes there is a tendency of the human being to look for scapegoats, someone to blame, especially if it's not me. We have such a thing called the ego, the pride, which is always self-protective, which would rather blame someone else except to look at the cause of the problem inside oneself. It's his fault, it's her fault, it's my father's fault, my mother's fault, my upbringing's fault, the government's fault, the system's fault, anyone's fault, not mine. Be aware of that tendency and stop this scapegoat fantasy. We always try and blame and put the burden on someone else. This is where the scapegoat came from. I think it was a Middle Eastern way where all of the wrongs and maldoings of a community, they choose a goat and they curse that goat as if they're putting all of the evil deeds on that goat. Poor old goat, didn't do anything. It wasn't his fault. And they drive that goat into the wilderness, or they drive it over a cliff, as if they could somehow, by punishing that goat, they could relieve themselves of all of their bad doings. And that's where we got the scapegoat idea. And this is something which we can do. We can blame other people, put all of what really lies with us onto something or someone else, and think that thereby we solve the problem. And has the problem been solved? No. Those communities had to choose a different goat every year. And we always need a different scapegoat all the time. Until we find, by either being pointed, by some decent teachings, or by having some insight and wisdom, the problem is not out there, the problem lies with us. So when we're looking for the origins of things, be careful of scapegoats. Look deeper than that, be honest, and see, where did this come from? The Buddha was saying, whether it's the source was his anger, or depression, or frustration, or whatever, that we will find that the source of all that we call suffering in this world, all that which we call problem in this world, the origin and source of these things comes from ignorance and desire. Look at it, see if this is true. When you get angry, why? You'll find that all sources of anger is because that there's something you wanted which has been taken away from you. There is something which you have worked for, which you've been frustrated in obtaining. The world isn't going the way you want it to go. Your desire is being thwarted. That results in what we call anger. Anger in all terms of all meanings of that word. Either anger to a person, anger to life, anger to oneself, anger to the heat, whatever. What happens if you give up desire for a few moments? Can anger survive the abandoning of desire? When you say that, doesn't matter how hot it is, or if I'm late, or if this person says this, or says that. If you have no desire, can you have anger? One starts to see that anger is arising from frustrated, thwarted, blocked desire. Much of that desire is what we call unwise desire. Desire which you can never achieve anyway. Desire which is unreasonable, irrational, because it cannot reach its goal. And it is why that there is a well-known part of the grieving process when someone dies, to get angry that someone close to you, dear to you, has been taken away. Sometimes we can curse. I remember going to performing a funeral for a Chinese man who had died. And it was one of the first funerals I performed in Perth, and I was a bit of a novice on the whole thing, and I was completely not knowing what to do when, in the middle of it, I was doing some chanting, the wife came up and started swearing at her husband who had died. What did you do this for? And she was really going. She was, you know, throwing her arms around and cursing him, and just her eyes were wide. It was a good job I didn't understand Chinese, otherwise I'd have been embarrassed. She was really mad. That anger can sometimes come up when something dear to us, close to our heart, has been removed and taken away.
many things which cause anger are just parts of nature which we cannot do anything about. If we had only noticed the origin of much which we get angry about is completely beyond our power to change, to alter, we'd give up being angry. We'd let go of that anger. The anger would appear to us to be so stupid, so foolish. Why am I being angry that the mountains are being mountains? Why am I being angry for it being hot during the summertime? Why am I being angry that people die? Why am I being angry that I fail sometimes and make mistakes? Why am I being angry that relationships come and go? Part of life, isn't it, that things come and go? If we can only see the cause of something like anger, see its origin, we'd see it is both desire and ignorance which are the causes, which are the origins of these things. Ignorance, because we don't understand clearly, we get angry at things we just can't change. It's like shouting at a mountain. After a while, you get hoarse, and that mountain doesn't move. And you realize that mountain's never going to move. And then you shut up shouting, and get on with your business. There is that story of, in the Jataka Tales, it's in the Dhammapada commentary, where a person had lost his son. When the son died, they cremated him, and the father would go to the cremation ground every evening crying his eyes out. During the day, he'd feel so tired because he'd been up all night crying, he could hardly do any business. The family allowed him to grieve for a week, thinking he'd get over it. But he didn't get over it, he kept going to the cremation ground every night, crying for his son who had died. The family hired an actor. The actor dressed up as a young man and went to that cremation ground one evening, also crying. The two of them bawling their eyes out in the cremation ground. After a while, they both noticed one another. And the old man who just lost his son said, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "I'm crying because yesterday was my birthday. My father promised he'd get me anything I wanted. He's a very rich man. But he didn't. That's why I'm crying. I'm so disappointed I didn't get what I wanted for my birthday." The old man who lost his son said, "Look, I'm a rich man too. What your father didn't get you, I can get you. I don't like to see other people crying. What do you want? And I'll get it for you." And the young man cheered up and said, "Great. Please get me what my father can get me for my birthday. What I want for my birthday, you can see it up there, the moon." And the old man looked at him and said, "No one can get you the moon for your birthday. You're foolish. Stop crying." The young man said, "Well, what are you crying for?" And the old man, who started weeping again, "I'm crying for my son who died. I want him back." And the young man sees his opportunity. "You call me a fool for crying for the moon. At least you can see the moon. Where's your son?" And when the old man realized he was crying for something he could never get, his son was dead, burnt to ashes, and the ashes in the urn. When he realized he was being angry for something he could not change, being sad for something which was beyond his power to alter, he gave up his crying and went back to home, had a rest, and went back to work. How much of our time are we crying for the moon? Being angry at things we cannot change. That's why I'm saying that, or Buddha was saying, the origin of these problems is desire plus ignorance. Whether it's jealousy, why are you jealous? I want to be like him too. I want to be like her. Why has she got it and not me? That even comes even to even a monastic life, spiritual life, even becoming enlightened. Sometimes that's any monks who have gained anything in the path, any state of enlightenment, sometimes other people get jealous of them. "Look, him, come off him. He can't be anywhere." Or even in meditation retreats. There was some people in a meditation center in the East who once wrote this song. with the chorus line, I'll be enlightened before you are. Here's who gets enlightened first. You get enlightened before me, great. I'll be proud of you. Well done. So the jealousy is ignorance saying that if you've got something, that means I haven't, therefore I'm worse than you. It's coming from wrong thinking, from ignorance and from desire. All suffering is coming from these things. And that which we think is really worthwhile trying to attain, what is desire anyway? That which we really want to attain. The ignorance means we're desiring that which is not really worth desiring. What do most people desire in this world? If I gave you 3 wishes, what would you ask for? And if I could give those 3 wishes to you, what would you ask yourself that question? If I had 3 wishes, what would I want? That's what you desire. The runaway is to be enlightened. The runaway is to be, may all people in the world be enlightened. Would it be, may all sickness be gone? Or is the first 3, may I be rich? May I have this beautiful partner in life, in these material things? Isn't it a shame that we're so concerned with material things? Well, the Buddha said, I just checked this this afternoon, in the Dhammapada, he was saying that that health is the highest gain, that contentment is the greatest wealth. It's a marvelous saying, isn't it? And nirvana is the highest happiness. Now let's analyse that. The health is the greatest gain. If you really want to gain something, like health, obviously, is much more important than gaining fame or gaining a sort of status in the world, getting your name on the newspapers as being such a beautiful, marvellous person, so tremendous, or having a big house in Peppermint Grove and another sort of country estate somewhere else. And look at me as a monk. I've got my city mansion here in Noramara, and we've got our country estate and Serpentine. But it doesn't belong to us. This is the difference. About all these material things which we aim for in life, and the Buddha was saying, no, health is the greatest gain, contentment is the greatest wealth. Would you like to be wealthy? Would you like to win the lotto? You know, some monks can give the right numbers. It's really a weird thing. Sometimes that happens. We're giving lottery numbers. Sometimes, once I was at this mountain, sitting meditation a lot of time, and just the day before the illegal lottery in Thailand came out, just 2 numbers, just from 1 to 100, and you get 60-1 odds on this. And people were coming up, can people give me a lottery number? And I said, no, I can't, it's against the rules. And some men, I remember coming up, they just showed me their hands, it's full of blisters. They had to work so hard. And that they really had blisters and bleeding, it was just terrible state of their hands. But the rules are different, so no, I can't, sorry, there's no way I can do this. And the day before the lottery came out, I had a load of people visiting me, asking me all sorts of questions. And the day of the lottery, hardly anyone came. Except in the following day, when one of the men was delegated by the village, and he said, I come from all the people in the village to invite you to stay a long time. You give very good lottery numbers. We've made a lot of money. I said, what? He said, you gave us a very good lottery number. I said, when and how? And he told me that in one of the conversations, I told them that in 2 or 3 days, I'll be leaving. 2 plus 3 means 5. And then afterwards, I told them, just a sentence later, well, you know, I'm not sure. And not sure means 0. And the number 50 came up and half the village bet on it. And the village made a fortune. And I had to leave. Because you can't do such things. Then why do people come to a monk and ask for lottery numbers for wealth? When health is the highest gain and contentment is the greatest wealth. Okay, so I make a lot of money on the lotto. What happens if I come back next week to ask another lotto number? And again and again and again and again. Are you ever satisfied?
If you had 1,000,000, would that be enough? 10 million? 50 million? Look at the Kelly Parkers, Adam Bonds in this world, can know the rest. Can never take a nice holiday like the Max store. What is the greatest wealth? Who is the wealthiest person in Australia? The one who's most content. You do not measure things in terms of dollars. You measure things in terms of contentment. So if we are going to desire something, let's have desire not with ignorance, but desire with wisdom. Not desire health, desire contentment. You don't need to have so much to be content, do you? You can be content just with a golden robe and a bald head. What a relief. You know, when I get up in the morning, I don't need to worry about what I wear. It's either this or nothing. I don't have to work really hard to get all the money to get the best clothes, watches, houses. How many years have you worked to pay off the mortgage? How many hours have you spent going to a job you may not have enjoyed so you can build an extra room on the back? Stupid, isn't it? Sometimes. What do you do it for? You do it because everyone else is doing it. This ignorance happens when we don't think things out for ourselves, we don't go to the origin of things, but we just follow what other people are doing. There's this beautiful story in Buddhism which the Buddhists would always teach the children. If you haven't heard it, I have to teach it to you now. You may have heard it before. A monkey was taking a snooze on a hot day underneath a coconut tree in the jungle. And during his dream, he was awoken by this huge explosion. A coconut fell from the tree right next to him. But because of his dream, he thought, the earth is exploding. It's the end of the world. And in great fear, he ran away from the tree, shouting, it's the end of the world, it's the end of the world. And he met a few rabbits, and they said, monkey, where are you going? It's the end of the world, it's the end of the world. And the rabbits thought, wow, it's the end of the world. And they ran after the monkey. And then I met a snake. What are you two running? Because it's the end of the world. Wow, it's the end of the world. And the snake started slithering away as well. And then the deer, and then the elephants, and then half the jungle animals were running away. It's the end of the world, it's the end of the world, until they met the lion, the king of the jungle. Where are you lot going? It's the end of the world, they all shouted. What do you mean the end of the world? How do you know it's the end of the world? Elephant, who told you it's the end of the world? The deer told me it was the end of the world. Deer, who told you it was the end of the world? It was the snake. Snake, who told you it was the end of the world? It was the rabbit. Rabbit, who told you it was the end of the world? It was a monkey. Monkey, who told you it was the end of the world? The monkey looked to the ground, feeling embarrassed. They all looked for the monkey. Who told you? And then the monkey remembered. I was sitting down, it was a huge explosion. It was the end of the world. The end of the world. And the lion said, come over here, monkey. Let's go back to see where the end of the world started. And they all went back and saw this huge coconut. And just next to the coconut was the pressed grass, just where the monkey had been lying, still warm from where he'd been sleeping. There's your end of the world, monkey. But let this be a lesson to all you animals. Never just follow what other people say. Don't just follow along like sheep in this world, but find these things out for yourself. Be wise, question, and don't stop until you've got a decent answer. Why are you buying expensive houses, Porsche cars, expensive clothes? Is this really wise desire? The Buddha says the greatest gain is health, the greatest wealth is contentment. So if you can have wise desire, let's go for these things, especially contentment. Let's work in our life to be content rather than be millionaire. When you actually go to the origin of things, you're going to the origin of happiness. It is contentment, isn't it? What does contentment mean? Contentment means you can sit down and you don't want anything more. Have you ever been in that situation? I remember years ago, I was at school, one of these members from my past, which is indelibly ingrained in my memory. Finishing all my, I was only about 13 at the time, finishing all my homework, having asked enough from school, and thinking that there's nothing that I want in the world. Everything is done. No duties, no jobs, nothing missing, nothing to be gained. The reason I remember it, because for that afternoon I was content. There's not a desire in my mind. Just enjoying every moment of the afternoon. Now that was truly a religious experience. An experience where there's no desire. Fortunately, it didn't last very long. It reminded me of what contentment is. And how that if one is going to work for anything in this world, one should work for that. For contentment. How do you gain contentment? What's the origin of contentment? Now this is an important point because the ignorant people in the world think that you'll gain contentment by fulfilling your desires. By gaining the object of your desire. I will be content once I win the lotto. I will be content once I get that Porsche. I will be content once I've paid off the mortgage. I will be content once I sort out my problems and meet the mate who is meant for me out there somewhere and live happily ever after. Even I'll be content once I buy that dress which I've seen in the window and which I really want. As a monk, I'll be content once the monastery is finished. I'll be content once Adam Jaffa returns. If that's what I think, I'm not going to be content. Whatever it is, if you think you're going to get contentment by fulfilling your desires, you'll find disappointment. It's one of the great disappointments in the world to win the lotto and think, is this all it is? It's one of the great disappointments in the world to become a millionaire and think, so what? So often in life, you'll find that which you work so hard for, that which you dreamed about, when it actually comes and occurs, it's not quite what you thought it was. You do not gain contentment by fulfilling your desires. You'll find that one desire will lead to another, will lead to another. It's thirst. Thirst which is not quenched by drinking. Take one glass of water and you want another one. That's what the world of desire. You gain contentment by going to the origin of desire, which is the fallacy of thinking that right now you haven't got enough. If you look, not what's missing, but what you have, you find that this is quite good enough, thank you. I've got a body, reasonable health, even if it's sick, it's good enough to work with. I've got good friends, they may not be the perfect friends, but they're good enough. I've got a husband, a wife, they may not be perfect, they may not be as beautiful as you see on the TV, but they're good enough. When you see what you have, not what's missing, you gain contentment. When I look at the monastery and all the things which need to be done in the monastery, all the buildings which need to be erected, gives rise to desire and discontent. When I look at all the things which are already there, contentment. When one can do this now and again, one realizes the greatest wealth is contentment. Another word for contentment is called gratitude. Gratitude is saying thank you for what's there. Thank you for being there. Thank you for just being as good as you are. Gratitude is saying thank you for what you have. And gives rise to contentment. The highest gain. The highest wealth, sorry. And once you can start to do this, you realize what it's worth while desiring this world. Okay, houses, cars, clothes and things are all right, but as long as they are not the main aim. As long as the main aim is contentment. So one's desire is wise. Once one has stopped the origin of suffering by overcoming ignorance and realizing what's worth desiring in this world, then one is on the path. Then
the problems of life are going to get less and less and less and less. You realize what's worthwhile trying to attain this life. Be content. Learn contentment. Realistic contentment. Well, be content no matter what you have, no matter what happens to you in life. Now the problem is that ignorance itself has its origin. Why are we ignorant? What's the origin of ignorance? And the origin of ignorance is again desire. Desire is the origin of ignorance, ignorance is the origin of desire. The way that desire affects ignorance is because we don't see what's there, we see what we want to see. We look at life through our desire. What you want becomes what you see. And so often you can, if you want to see someone fail, you want to see their faults, you could get angry at them, what do you see in them? You see all the niggly things, all the bad things in them, all their mistakes, you see mistake after mistake after mistake. When you look at a person, you judge them according to what you want to see in them. When you look at yourself, what do you see? You see what you're looking for. If you're in a bad mood, if you're negative, you look at your thoughts. If there's someone you hate in this world, you will see only their thoughts. With a person, you see what you're looking for. You don't see what is there. If you really like someone, if you fall in love with someone, what do you see? You see only they're such a fabulous person. They're so beautiful, so strong, and so wise, and caring, and compassionate, and you fall in love with them, and you're surprised 1 year later when they're something different. And you find out that's quite not quite. You think, well, what's happened here? Have they changed? No, they're always like that. It just was you weren't seeing clearly. And then a few years later, you don't just see the good and the bad, you only see the bad. And things change. And so often in life, ignorance happens because we see what we were looking for, what we want to see. In life, in ourselves, in the world. Once you actually experience that the way we look at the world is actually clouded by our desires, we see what we're looking for, and we actually we cook the book to produce the results we want, and that shows us how desire is the cause, the origin of ignorance. It's why we're in a terrible cycle, why human beings go round and round and round, never really understanding, never really getting clear of the problems of difficulties of suffering. Why is it that we keep on falling over in life, stumbling between between traumas and difficulties of life? Why is it we can't understand? Because of this origin of the whole mess of stuff, which is desire and ignorance. Desire causing ignorance, ignorance causing desire, desire causing ignorance, not seeing clearly. And the Buddha said, this is the origin of the world, these two things. Desire and ignorance. Working together very hard to stop. There is a way of stopping it though. And that way of stopping it is through getting a pause of desire and ignorance. A time where they can just stop for a moment so we can truly see who we are, what we are, and where we're going. Even though desire and ignorance keep on going, but they can stop now and again. The stopping of desire and ignorance is the purpose of meditation practice. To sit still, if you achieve stillness, you're achieving the end temporarily of desire. Desire is what takes you away from being still. Because if you're sitting here, and there's something out there which you think of, something out there which you see, it's just, you know, you listen to a talk and the ice cream van goes past. That'd be nice. That's desire. It takes you away from where you are. Meditation is suppressing desire for the time being. Instead of allowing the mind to go wherever it wants, put it on one thing. If you achieve that stillness, you've achieved the cessation of desire for a while. And you know what that's like. What's it like to stop desire? What's it like to stop the origin of the world? You find that that is true contentment. You'll find from your experience that the experiences of stillness and peace in meditation becomes the highest contentment. Contentment as an experience. And that is why that people meditate, to drink of that contentment more and more. Once one experiences this, one knows that contentment is indeed the highest gain, the highest pleasure in life. That experience, that understanding, is an ending of ignorance. You start to see really what the world is made of, what is its origin, and also what is the end of that world. The world of suffering, the world of difficulty, the world of anger and desire, and the ending of that, one sees that in contentment. So the practice of meditation is such an important, vital part of Buddhist path. It is actually doing the job of ending desire and ignorance temporarily, just to test the water, see what it's like to have not one desire in the world, nothing to take you away from where you are. Seeing what that's like. Not ignorance anymore, but experience. When one sees this, one sees the origin of the world. When one sees the origin of the world and sees the origins of problems, then one can stop those problems. One has to see the cause first before one can treat the illness. And that's why, in the way of Buddhism, origins are the origin of the world we make. When we see the origin of the world we make, we see the way we can remake that world so that it's not through ignorance anymore, not through desires which cause problems, but through desires which can help and serve in the world. Compassionate, kind, positive desires. That which you can achieve, that which is for our happiness and the happiness of others. So seeing the origin of that which is good and that which is bad, that which is suffering and that which is happiness, we do something about it. And if we're talking about creating the world, this is what we do. The creator is our own actions of body, speech and mind. Not outside of ourselves, but inside of ourselves. So if anyone asks you why, if anyone asks you where did all this come from, you don't need to look any further than inside of you. And there, I guarantee, or your money back, you will find the source, the origin of the problem. Just find that origin and you will solve the problem. So that's the talk I'm giving this evening on the origin of the world. Has anyone got any questions or comments they'd like to make on this evening's talk? Okay, there's no questions or comments. So? Okay. Yeah. Human beings come from clothing. Okay. You're saying we have to rewrite the sociology books and maybe the biology books and psychology books as well. You were saying that someone just said that human beings come from soybeans. Some people say that human beings came from some country in Africa somewhere. This is not the point, is it? Where the body comes from. Somebody asked Ajahn Chah once where he came from, and he said he came from the womb of his mother. Mm-hmm. Well, good answer. But that's not really the true answer, is it? And the true, that's only body. But where do you come from? where do you come from? The answer is you come from where you were before. Where was that? Last moment, the moment before, the moment before that. Continually building yourself. If I can only sort of see that builder, the originator, which the Buddha said was desire and ignorance, then you're getting somewhere in this world. So anyway, we may have the announcements now. So if you someone come up with the announcements, there's a special announcement to make this evening, which I'll make maybe. Okay, the special announcement is, you may remember two weeks or 3 weeks ago, we had the ABC TV cameras coming to do a documentary on the Buddhist Society and the monastery. And wouldn't you know it, they screened it this evening, about an hour ago. But, having been forewarned, because we've overcome ignorance, well, we've got a bit of desire left, we desire to show it at 9:30 in the videotape. And so after the announcements, if you want, we're going to have a cup of tea or ask some questions. If you're interested in seeing us on the 7:30 report this evening, and on the ABC, if you wish to see it, it should have been videotaped, and we'll show it in here about 9:30. So if you want to see the ABC report about the monastery, see how we came across and see whether we should write a letter of complaint or not, then please come back at 9:30. And we have other announcements now.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much, Ivan. Welcome to everybody who's tonight. And if it's the first time, a particular welcome to you. Just a couple of announcements tonight. One of them to remind people that receipts from membership fees are available at the desk just inside the house, or save as posting them. And the final one is to offer you an opportunity to come along and help at a busy beach tomorrow morning. If we all enjoy these beautiful premises and recognise that the upkeep of them takes a small army of people actually to keep them up to scratch all the time. We have a couple of important things coming up in the next few weeks, an ordination and the return we hope of Ajahn Jagra. And there's also just the normal quarterly sprinkling that needs to happen around the place. It's probably going to be warm, so the more people who can come, the shorter the time that we'll need to spend. So if you can spare just a little bit of time even tomorrow, it would be greatly appreciated. We'll be meeting about 8 o'clock tomorrow morning in the cooler part of the day. And if you could bring any gardening implements you have, cutters, weeding tools, anything at all that you can bring along to help, that would be appreciated, as well as cleaning materials, rubber gloves, buckets, anything at all like that, so that we can share the tasks around and get the jobs done around by the local very quickly. I hope that we'll be able to see you then. And I'd like you now to come and have a cup of tea and have a little chat before we come back to the news. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. And we just play a space of Buddha Dhamma and Sangha and have something to drink, and then we come back for the video.